KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump fired more than a dozen inspectors general at agencies such as the State Department. The firings happened with no warning, and it leaves those agencies with no oversight. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The president says Palestinians living in the destruction inside Gaza should go somewhere else. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. He wants Egypt and Jordan to take them in. We'll hear how willing or capable they are to do it. Also, the Super Bowl matchup is now set. The Kansas City Chiefs will try to be the first team to win three straight if they get past the high-flying Philadelphia Eagles in New Orleans. It's Monday, January 27th. Ari Shapiro's cabaret duet partner, Alan Cumming, turns 60 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. It's the second week of President Trump's second term in the White House. Several key cabinet positions are now filled as confirmation hearings continue this week for others. Over the weekend, the Senate confirmed former South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem as Homeland Security Secretary. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. will appear before a Senate panel Thursday for the first of his hearings to consider his nomination as Health and Human Services Secretary. This morning, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth reported to the Pentagon, focused on immigration.
We are reorienting. This is a shift. This is not the way business has been done in the past. This is the Defense Department will support the defense of the territorial integrity of the United States of America at the southern border, to include reservists, National Guard, and active duty in compliance with the Constitution, the laws of our land, and the directives of the Commander-in-Chief.
On Capitol Hill, some Republican lawmakers are defending President Trump's decision to fire several inspectors general Friday night. They investigate misconduct and waste at government agencies. As NPR's Elena Moore reports, Trump appears to have sidestepped federal law, which requires the president to notify Congress 30 days in advance of the removal of an inspector general.
GOP allies like South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham acknowledge Trump should have notified Congress before firing the inspectors general. Still, he told CNN's State of the Union that he backs the president's move.
The question is it okay for him to put people in place that he thinks can carry out his agenda? Yeah. He won the election. What do you expect him to do, just leave everybody in place in Washington before he got elected? This makes perfect sense to me.
It comes a day after Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, who chairs the Judiciary Committee, demanded more information from Trump on the firings, saying in a statement, quote, there may be good reason the IGs were fired. We need to know that, if so. Elena Moore, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks opened lower this morning as China shows off a new artificial intelligence product. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow tumbled 110 points in early trading.
Chinese startup DeepSeek says its new AI chatbot rivals the performance of U.S. competitors at a lower cost. The threat of cheap Chinese competition rattled investors who poured billions of dollars into AI software and hardware. Some sky-high stock valuations are now getting a second look. Coffee drinkers and romantics can breathe a sigh of relief now that a threatened trade war between the U.S. and Colombia has been averted. President Trump had threatened to slap steep tariffs on imports from Colombia, which could have raised prices for both coffee and Valentine's Day roses. Those tariffs are on hold now that Colombia's agreed to allow military flights carrying Colombian immigrants deported by the U.S. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
It's NPR. Hamas has agreed to release three more Israeli hostages on Thursday, and Israel is allowing displaced Palestinians to return to North Gaza for the first time since the start of the war. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
Israel and Hamas say they have resolved a dispute involving an Israeli hostage whom Hamas did not release last week as Israel had expected. Hamas has now agreed to free that hostage plus two more on Thursday, and Hamas will release three additional hostages on Saturday as previously scheduled. In total, six hostages will be freed this week, and Israel will release Palestinian prisoners and detainees. Hamas has also given Israel a list detailing the condition of each hostage who will be freed in the coming weeks. In return for these gestures, Israel says it is finally allowing the return of displaced Palestinians to North Gaza. Throngs are now returning by foot. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Today is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. This year marks 80 years since the liberation of Auschwitz by the Soviet Army. An observance is being held at the site of the former death camp in Poland. Nazi German forces murdered more than 1 million people at Auschwitz during World War II. Most were Jews killed in gas chambers. In all, more than 6 million Jewish people across Europe were murdered. Poland's president joined remaining Auschwitz survivors at today's ceremony, which comes during a time of rising anti-Semitism in Europe. I'm Kristen Wright, and this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Trump says firing more than a dozen watchdog officials is both common and standard. We ask a former inspector general about that. But first,
the White House is claiming victory in a deportation showdown between the United States and Colombia. As John Otis reports from Bogota, the two countries threatened each other with tariffs before Colombia backed down.
On Sunday, the Trump administration tried to send two military aircraft loaded with 160 deportees back to Colombia. But when the planes were already in the air, Colombian President Gustavo Petro revoked their landing rights. Trump responded by threatening to impose 25% tariffs on Colombian imports, financial sanctions, and visa restrictions on Colombian government officials.
It looks like Trump is trying to make an example of Colombia for all countries that might be reluctant to take these planes.
That's Adam Isaacson of the Washington Office on Latin America, which advocates for human rights in the Americas. He points out that Trump has also sparred with Mexico and has threatened to seize the Panama Canal.
Trump, especially with the Americas, seems to be choosing bullying and humiliation as one of the central tactics in order to get his way.
Until recently, the left-wing Petro government had been cooperating with the U.S. Last year, according to U.S. government figures, Colombia accepted 124 deportation flights. However, those were civilian flights. Now, Trump is using military aircraft, and there have been complaints of mistreatment. Last week, deported Brazilians arrived home in handcuffs and were subjected to, quote, degrading treatment, according to the Brazilian government. In a post on X, Petro said he would not accept deportation flights until migrants are treated with respect. And after learning of Trump's sanctions, Petro announced reciprocal tariffs on U.S. imports and said in a message to Trump, quote, "Your blockade doesn't frighten me." But apparently, Petro had second thoughts. The U.S. tariffs would have affected coffee, flowers, and more than 11,000 other Colombian goods.
Seguiremos recibiendo a los colombianos.
Late Sunday night, Colombian Foreign Minister Luis Gilberto Murillo announced that the impasse was over and that the country would, in fact, continue to receive deportation flights. The White House claimed Colombia had agreed to all of Trump's terms, including the use of military aircraft for deportation. Isaacson pointed out that Colombia has been Washington's most loyal ally in Latin America for the past quarter century.
You need Colombia's cooperation on the fight against cocaine. They're a key trading partner, long-standing military cooperation.
That's why, he said, blowing up bilateral relations over immigration makes little sense. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Bogota, Colombia.
Florida is one of several states where Republicans are considering action to help President Trump with his pledge for a mass deportation of immigrants who do not have legal status.
Governor Ron DeSantis has called lawmakers to a special session today to take up his proposals, including one that would require local officials to help carry out deportations or face suspension.
NPR's Greg Allen joins us now from Miami. So, Greg, what does Governor DeSantis have in mind?
Well, you'll recall that DeSantis ran for the Republican presidential nomination against Donald Trump, and they were rivals, but now they're working together, and Trump has expressed support for this special session. DeSantis says he talked to Trump about his plans on immigration before the inauguration and says illegal immigration has resulted in massive costs to the American people.
Clearly, I don't think you could have a stronger mandate for action on the issue of immigration than what we have right now, and Florida leads.
Among the proposals that DeSantis wants is one that would require counties and cities to participate in the federal deportation program, and it would give him the authority to suspend any officials who don't comply, including those who are elected. He wants to make it a state crime to enter the U.S. illegally. He also wants to require people to show ID and their immigration status before sending money back home, which would essentially prohibit anyone who's here without legal status from sending any money in remittances back to their home country.
So which of these proposals are lawmakers expected to pass?
Well, at this point, it's not clear if they're going to pass anything this week. As governor, DeSantis has the authority to convene a special session. But when he called this one, Republican leaders in the state House and Senate pushed back immediately. They said taking up immigration at this time is premature, in their words. In their letter, the House Speaker and Senate President told DeSantis, when it comes to immigration, we are strong supporters of President Trump and stand ready to follow his lead. So this really isn't just about immigration. This is about a governor who's been accused of being heavy-handed with members of his own party in the past and is now in his last term and might not have the political clout he once did.
Florida has a lot of immigrants, Greg. I mean, so what does this mean for them?
Well, one out of every five Floridians is an immigrant. The executive orders and actions taken by the Trump administration so far have many immigrant communities here shaken. Tessa Pettit, who heads the Florida Immigrant Coalition, says if it passes, DeSantis' proposal to turn local law enforcement into immigration agents will only increase that fear.
People are going to be afraid of police officers. People are going to be afraid to report crimes. That's going to create a very strong divide between law enforcement and community members.
Pettit also says blocking remittances will send shockwaves, not just through the immigrant communities here, but also to other countries like Haiti and Nicaragua that depend heavily on money from people in the U.S.
Yeah. Now, what's likely to happen this week, you think?
Well, you know, at least for now, Governor DeSantis says he's focused on immigration and could call lawmakers back into another special session if they don't take action now. But Republican leaders say the legislature will meet for its regular session in just over a month, and they want to deal with immigration and other issues on their schedule and during that session if they have their rights. It's clear immigration is going to be a big issue, though, in legislatures across the country this year. Republican-led states are looking at many of these proposals being considered in Florida. For example, Tennessee's legislature is also meeting today to discuss immigration. So states led by Democrats are responding. They're going to court to challenge some of the executive orders and policies on immigration coming from the Trump administration. So this is going to be going on for all the year, it looks like.
Yeah. The NPR's Greg Allen in Miami. Greg, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
More than a dozen federal agencies are starting this week without their inspectors general, including at the Department of Defense, State Health and Human Services, The list goes on. President Trump fired them late Friday. Inspectors General are independent watchdogs who work within agencies to call out waste, fraud, and abuse of power. Joining me to discuss this news is Glenn Fine. He was the Justice Department's Inspector General for more than a decade, and more recently he was acting Inspector General at the Pentagon during Trump's first term. Good morning, Glenn. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So is this move legal?
Well, it didn't follow the Inspector General Act, which requires the president, if he wants to remove an inspector general, which he's allowed to do, but he must give Congress 30 days notice before the removal. And the substantive rationale with detailed and case-specific reasons for each removal. That's under the Inspector General Act. It was passed in a bipartisan amendment in 2022, and that didn't happen when these inspectors general were told they were being removed, apparently by an email from somebody in the Office of Presidential Personnel, and effective immediately. So it did not adhere to the Inspector General Act requirements.
Now, the legality is also something Republican Senator Chuck Grassley and the Council of Inspectors General on Integrity and Efficiency are both questioning. But the president said this is a very common thing to do. Is it a very common thing to do?
It is not a very common thing to do, particularly this level of mass firings. The Inspector General Act was passed in 1978 as part of good government reform. And in the first transition after that, President Reagan removed all the IGs. But there was a hue and cry in Congress who vociferously protested because they're supposed to be nonpartisan and remain when administrations changed. And President Reagan hired back many of those IGs. And since then, no, there have not been mass removals like that. There are some removals occasionally. President Obama removed one. President Biden removed one. President Trump in his first administration removed several. But it's not been like this, where 17 or more inspectors general were removed en masse at the beginning of an administration without substantive reasons given.
Towards the end of Trump's first term, as you mentioned, he dismissed a few inspectors general, including you. What happened in your case?
Well, I was the acting inspector general for the Department of Defense for 4.5 years. I had been also the inspector general of the Department of Justice for 11 years under both Republican and Democratic administrations. Then the pandemic hit in 2020 and COVID relief funds were given out. And there was a committee of IGs created to oversee the use of those funds. I was selected to be the chair of that committee. And then I was removed by President Trump within a few days of that. It wasn't illegal. He was allowed to do that, and that ended my career as the acting Inspector General of the Department of Defense.
Trump said he would install new inspectors general, and he also was asked if he would install loyalists in these positions, and he said he didn't know anyone who would do that, saying he wouldn't do that. What happens to oversight at these agencies in the meantime?
Well, IGs are supposed to be nonpartisan. They're to be selected according to the IG Act without regard to their political affiliation, and their effectiveness depends on them being non-political. And so it is important that they be viewed as not tied to one party or another, or hired or fired like any other political appointees in an administration. Otherwise, their credibility, independence, and effectiveness and impact is diminished. So I would hope that he would hire people who have experience in investigations or auditing, that are not political in any way, that are not tied to one political party, and have the credibility and independence and effectiveness to perform this critically important oversight role, which provides a check and balance in each government agency and is critically needed.
Glenn Fine, former Inspector General and author of the book, Watchdogs, Inspectors General, and the Battle for Honest and Accountable Government. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, as part of Saturday Night Live's 50th anniversary celebration, Amir Questlove Thompson has co-directed a new documentary about the show's musical guests and musical sketches. He'll share behind-the-scenes stories and tell us how the SNL band influenced him as leader of The Roots, The Tonight Show's house band. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from The Station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. All right, this year's Super Bowl is all set.
The Kansas City Chiefs and the Philadelphia Eagles are set for a rematch of the big game from 2 seasons ago. The Chiefs won that game and last year's too. Now they're looking to be the first team in Super Bowl history to go back to back to back.
NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan joins us now from Philadelphia. So, Becky, I mean, the Chiefs, one game away from being the first team in NFL history to win 3 straight Super Bowls, if they can do it. So why hasn't that happened before? I mean, I know that football is hard, but come on.
Yeah, I mean, it really is crazy. And before I answer your question, actually, like, I mean, just to point out, this has happened multiple times in Major League Baseball, in the NBA, in the NHL, and in fairly recent history, in fact, in some of those. So the fact that it hasn't happened with Super Bowls, I think, is pretty wild. And so there's a lot of reasons for it. There's more injuries in football. The rosters, the team sizes, they're just bigger, so it's harder to keep core groups together year to year. Good teams have coaches get poached away. Kansas City has been lucky in those ways. And injuries helped take down other contenders this year, like we saw with the Detroit Lions. Chiefs have been mostly healthy, able to find replacements for players. And the team, a lot of the team's important players have stayed in place, led, of course, by quarterback Patrick Mahomes, who has just been tremendous in the playoffs. Very close game last night with the Buffalo Bills, back and forth a lot. Came down to the final few minutes, the Chiefs won it 32-29. And I think a lot of people have really come to see their success in the playoffs as inevitable.
They're really good. They also get a lot of breaks, but, you know, there you go. I'm an AFC West person, so I can see it twice a year every year. You're in Philadelphia, though. You are at the Eagles game yesterday. How did they get it done?
Oh, yeah. They played the Washington Commanders, who were this year's playoff Cinderella story. But they really, the Eagles came out and really set this tone right away. So first quarter, start of the first quarter, Commanders have the ball first. It took them just so much effort to get down the field on that first drive. It was an 18-play drive. They were just getting a few yards at a time, were held to a field goal. Then the Eagles get the ball, and on their very first play from scrimmage, their star running back, Saquon Barkley, broke free for a 60-yard touchdown. His teammates afterward were just singing praises about how that play started things off for them. And here's Eagles offensive lineman Jordan Mailata.
I don't know, man. I wish we had a camera in our helmet so you guys could just see that view. Truly special. I was just running after him trying to make sure that, you know, if anything happened, if he fumbled the ball, jump on it. But, man, guy went to the house.
Yeah. And there were just a lot of unforced errors by the Commanders. 3 fumbles, an interception, some consequential penalties. But honestly, the Eagles, I thought, just looked better. I mean, they scored 55 points. Hard to argue with that.
Yes. I mean, that's a lot of points in any game, much less a playoff game. So one thing, though, Becky, I mean, of the 4 teams that played on Sunday, the Chiefs and Eagles might have been the Super Bowl matchup that the fewest people may have been hoping for.
I definitely think you're right about that. I think people understandably have some Chiefs fatigue. This is their 5th Super Bowl appearance in the past 6 years. Even the Tom Brady New England Patriots dynasty never did that. That's a lot of, you know, having one dynasty ruled over by Brady in the AFC conference. Now you have the Chiefs showing their grip on that conference too. On the other side, Philly has also been really successful in recent years. They won it all in the 2017 season. Of course, they appeared with the Chiefs a couple years ago. But both teams have looked like contenders all season, I think. And so the Super Bowl, now it's just under 2 weeks away. I think there's a lot to look forward to.
Countdown begins. That's NPR's Becky Sullivan. Becky, thanks.
You're welcome.
You've likely heard of rehabilitation after a surgery, but if you're one of the millions of Americans getting ready for a joint replacement or another major operation, you may want to ask your doctor about prehabilitation. NPR's Allison Opry explains.
Prehabilitation is what you can do before a surgery to improve your chances of recovery. And a new study finds if you plan to go under the knife, taking time to prepare your mind and your body can really pay off. Here's study author Dr. Dan McIsaac, a professor at the University of Ottawa.
No matter what type of surgery you're preparing for, there's likely a benefit from prehabilitation.
So what exactly does this entail? Well, the top strategy is movement. The research shows people who do strength building and other forms of physical activity in the month or two before actually do better.
We found that doing exercise before surgery showed really promising results, reducing the risk of complications by about 40%, decreasing length of stay oftentimes by a day, and making a meaningful difference in how patients experience their recovery.
Another strategy is nutrition. In particular, Dr. McIsaac says it's important to up your protein intake, especially for people who have low muscle mass or frailty.
When you get into the operating room and you go under the knife, your body undergoes a stress response and it actually starts to pull protein out of your muscles to support the healing and stuff that's going to have to happen.
The research suggests that adding more high-protein foods, even for just a few weeks before an operation, can help. And a third component that makes a difference is to mentally prepare. Participants did everything from breathing exercises to talk therapy.
Many of them were stress management or anxiety management interventions. You can imagine you're being told you're going to the operating room in a couple of weeks. That can be a very stressful experience.
The study analyzed about 15,000 patients who'd undergone many different types of prehabilitation. And Dr. Samir Sinha, a geriatrician at University Health Network in Toronto, says it's helpful to see data on what really can work.
What they looked at is a variety of studies, you know, over, I think it was 186 trials that really kind of looked at a whole combination of these things. And so by pooling all of those together, you're able to kind of measure different outcomes.
Dr. Sinha was not involved in the study, but he treats a lot of older patients. So he says the findings offer up an important validation.
This notion of prehabilitation has been around for a while, but it's really nice when you see a study that can actually say, yeah, what we kind of knew inherently made sense actually really does work and can have significant benefits.
Dr. Sinha thinks of it as being battle ready or game ready. The combination of exercise, nutrition, and emotional support can build a reserve that pays off. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. And from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public.
This is NPR News.
Growing up, musician Nico Case knew very little about where she came from. She had no idea that her grandmother played in a band of her own or that her aunt was a famous wrestler. Those were discoveries she stumbled into later in life.
You'll never know where you come from because nobody's going to tell you.
Nico Case on her new memoir and upbringing on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement says it made more than 950 arrests across the country yesterday as part of President Trump's plan to apprehend and deport people who are in the country without legal status. They included arrests in Chicago and Denver. The president's border czar, Tom Homan, has said those considered threats to national security or public safety are the top priority. Stella Chavez with member station KERA reports on arrests made in North Texas.
An ICE spokesperson confirmed in an email that ICE and federal law enforcement partners arrested dozens of people in North Texas, including in Dallas, Fort Worth, and Arlington. Targeted operations also were conducted in Austin, according to NPR member station KUT. Other agencies involved in these operations include the FBI, ATF, DEA, and the U.S. Marshals Service. Governor Greg Abbott posted on X that Texas Department of Public Safety troopers and special agents were deployed to assist. For NPR News, I'm Stella Chavez in Dallas.
Word that a Chinese startup known as DeepSeek can produce artificial intelligence chatbots at a lower cost than U.S. rivals sent tech stocks on Wall Street sharply lower this morning. This is NPR News. An exhibit featuring a recreation of the annex in Amsterdam, where Anne Frank wrote her famous diary while hiding from the Nazis, is now open in New York City. Jessica Gould with member station WNYC has more.
Anne Frank, the exhibition at the Center for Jewish History, will guide visitors into the hidden, cramped quarters where she, her family, and four others lived for 2 years before being discovered and sent to death camps. There are 100 artifacts from the occupants' lives, some on display for the first time, and a recreation of the desk where Anne wrote her diary, including the words, "In spite of everything, I still believe people are really good at heart." The exhibit is a partnership with the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam and will be in New York City through April, with plans to travel to cities across the country after. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Gould in New York.
The Kansas City Chiefs will be seeking their third consecutive Super Bowl trophy when they play the Philadelphia Eagles in Super Bowl 59. The Chiefs won the AFC title yesterday by beating the Buffalo Bills in Kansas City 32-29. The Eagles won the NFC championship by routing the Washington Commanders 55-23 in Philadelphia. The Super Bowl will be played in New Orleans in 2 weeks. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadil in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Trump stunned Arab allies to the U.S. along with Palestinian leaders this weekend when he suggested that Palestinians in Gaza go to Jordan and Egypt.
You're talking about probably 1.5 million people, and we just clean out that whole thing. It's, you know, it's over the centuries, that's had many, many conflicts inside. And I don't know, it's something has to happen. But
Jordan's foreign minister publicly said it would refuse the displacement of Palestinians to Jordan. Palestinian groups called it a red line, and the Arab League said uprooting Palestinians from their land would be ethnic cleansing. But it is a proposal that's popular with the far right in Israel. To discuss this, we're joined by Khalid El-Gindi, a visiting scholar at Georgetown University's Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. Good morning, and thanks for being on the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So in Trump's statement over the weekend, he said it could be temporary or long term. If this is adopted as policy, how much of a departure is it for the U.S.?
I think it's fairly major departure. I mean, this is not a new idea that Palestinians be relocated elsewhere, but it's pretty new coming from a sitting U.S. president. And in that sense, it's quite alarming.
I mean, we even heard some concern from one of Trump's Senate allies, Republican Lindsey Graham. He said on CNN that the suggestion was not overly practical. And then I'm going to play you what Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman Safadi, said to me a few months ago about why Jordan hadn't and wouldn't take war refugees from Gaza.
Israel is making Gaza unlivable and uninhabitable, and therefore it has a policy of emptying Gaza of its people, and we simply will not allow that to happen because that will only put the region on a course towards more destruction and future wars.
Do you agree with that statement?
Yeah, I think so. I think actually he's been quite diplomatic. I mean, it would be extraordinarily destabilizing for those countries that receive Palestinian refugees. And frankly, even for Israel, it would, I think, bring decades of conflict to displace Palestinians. I mean, this is the root cause of the Israel-Palestine conflict to begin with, and that is the mass displacement of Palestinians from their land and homes in 1948. And so if you want to perpetuate the conflict into the future indefinitely, this would be the way to do that.
Now, Jordan and Egypt have made clear for a long time that they wouldn't want the mass displacement of Palestinians into their country, but they depend on the U.S. for foreign aid. Could this be something that the president could pressure these two U.S. allies into?
It could be, and of course, it's the sort of thing that Donald Trump has used that kind of pressure with Arab allies in the past. I don't think it would work. I mean, it's not a new idea. The Israeli far right, including members of Netanyahu's coalition, have been agitating for exactly this scenario for some time, particularly in the last 15 months. But it's always been firmly rejected. If there were a price for Egypt and Jordan, it would have happened by now. It would have been achieved.
Now, we also heard Elise Stefanik, Trump's pick for UN ambassador, and his pick for U.S. ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, say they believe Israel has a biblical right to the occupied West Bank, which is seen by Palestinians as part of their future state. Taken together, what does all of this say about the Trump administration's approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Yeah, and it's not just seen by Palestinians. It's seen by the entirety of
the international community.
As occupied territory, and that Palestinians are entitled to have a right to self-determination in their homeland. So I think it is pretty alarming. I mean, the United States is not a theocracy. Religious scripture, religious ideas are not a sound basis for making foreign policy. And I think it's not a good sign that these individuals are part of the Trump administration.
Khalid El-Gindi is a visiting scholar at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. Thank you for your time and your insights.
Thanks for having me.
Federal agencies have submitted plans for their workers to return to the office full-time for the first time since the pandemic, as directed by President Trump. That means thousands of government workers will likely descend on Washington each day. Scott Massioni from member station WYPR reports from Baltimore.
It takes Lane 20 minutes to drive to the train station in Baltimore.
The train ride is anywhere from about 40 minutes to an hour. I wake up at 4:10 in the morning. And I get to work bright and early between about 6 and 6:15.
Lane's a federal employee and works in person 2 days a week, a common setup for some federal workers. NPR is only using her middle name because she fears speaking out about the new telework policies may jeopardize her job. Lane says she works those two in-person days back-to-back, finishing up at the office around 3 p.m. and getting back home around 5.
You know, I'm so exhausted at the end of the day. By that third morning, when I'm, you know, waking up and teleworking, I am just so brain dead. It's actually hard to focus that next day. I cannot imagine trying to get in the car and go in a third day.
Lane, like many of the more than 300,000 federal employees in the surrounding D.C. area, may have to find a way to make it into the office 5 days a week, depending on how agencies implement a new executive memo from the Trump administration. While D.C.'s home to many federal agency headquarters, many employees choose to live outside the city. David Johnson, the deputy director of Maryland's MART train service, says they're ready for new commuters.
We're currently at about 50% pre-pandemic ridership, so we do have capacity to accommodate additional passengers.
The Trump administration's memo claims that telework has degraded government services and made it difficult to supervise workers. However, federal agencies have had telework policies and agreements with employees for 15 years. The Office of Personnel Management has produced numerous studies that show federal teleworking improves morale, retention, and stress. Some agencies have done studies that showed productivity increases when people telework because they have more flexibility. For some workers living outside the city, it's also a cheaper option. According to Zillow, the average home in D.C. is more than $600,000, and the average rent is between $2,200 and $2,500. Lane moved from D.C. to Baltimore about 40 miles away 20 years ago when her spouse got a job there.
We were actually able to buy a house here where we couldn't in D.C. due to cost. You know, at this point, we have a life here. So moving back to the D.C. area is not something that's particularly financially feasible and not a particularly pleasant option either.
Lane says there are people in her office who live as far away as Delaware or Pennsylvania. Some of them rent rooms and shared houses for the days they have to be in the office. She says for her and for many other federal employees, no telework options would likely make her reconsider staying at her agency. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni in Baltimore.
This is NPR News.
President Trump is ordering all federal workers back to the office. A Stanford professor says a couple days of remote work is good for productivity and workers like it. Next time, Here and Now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, me Martinez. A 20-year-old pizza delivery person trudged half a mile through the Indiana snow to drop off an order. His chilly reception, a $2 tip. On his way back to his car, Connor Stefanoff crossed paths with a police officer who was so shocked that he recorded the moment and posted it on TikTok. Officer Richard Craig then grabbed some cash from his car to give him a better tip, and he started a GoFundMe, which raised more than $30,000 for Stefanoff. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments, As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. One of the toughest winter endurance races in the world gets underway today in far northern Minnesota. It's called the Arrowhead Ultra 135. Skiers, bikers, and runners race the equivalent of more than five marathons over a snowy trail through the night alone. One of the competitors hopes to become the oldest person ever to finish the race on foot. He's 74 years old. Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker introduces us to him.
The conditions when I met Michael Coppi recently for a training run on a snowmobile trail outside Duluth were perfect, at least if your goal is to prepare for the Arrowhead 135. The wind chill was 20 below zero.
I've got several layers, but, you know, as I move more, and especially when you're pulling up big hills, you really warm up fast.
Coppi hauls a sled carrying about 40 pounds of survival gear required to compete in the race. Secured on the back is a small insulated container he built to keep his food and water from freezing. But his biggest fear is getting too warm, because if he sweats, that means later he's going to freeze.
You've got to be on that edge all the time. If you're comfortable, you're in a bad place.
Getting too comfortable is not in Coppi's DNA. The retired college instructor began running in high school. Later, he progressed to marathons and triathlons. After he turned 50, he added ultras, races 50 kilometers, that's 31 miles and longer. 5 years ago, he recorded the fastest known time for running a rugged 300-mile trail along Lake Superior. Last spring, he won the over 70 division of a 250-mile race in Arizona. He says the expression, a runner's high, that's a real thing.
You can zone out and you can get into what's called the flow, where time sort of disappears. I mean, it really does. You can be running 30, 40 miles and it feels like it was 10 minutes.
Coppi says there's magic in those moments, but make no mistake, there's also plenty of suffering. For a 200-mile race, Coppi sleeps only about 5 hours over 2 to 3 days.
And if you have to have a little pity party, go ahead and do it for 5 minutes, but then you got to just let it go and move on.
Coppi doesn't see himself as a role model, but he's inspired Christine Palowitz, who works at the YMCA in Duluth. Coppi is raising money for the Y through his racing this year. Palowitz is a runner, but she stopped after having a baby a couple years ago. Now, after meeting Coppi,
I was like, there's no reason that I can't get out there for a mile or 2 miles. And, you know, with running, it can be so hard that when you finish, you're mentally stronger to take on the day.
Coppi says for him, his age is irrelevant. He just thinks about whether he can do something, or at least try to see if he can. That's his approach to the Arrowhead 135, which he admits is scary.
It's out of my comfort zone. I mean, I've trained hard for it and tried to be in different situations, but I know I'm going to learn a bunch of stuff out there, and some of them the hard way.
After the Arrowhead, Coppi plans to run the Western States 100 through the Sierra Nevada Mountains. It's one of the most prestigious ultras in the world. He's aiming to become the oldest runner ever to finish that race, too. For NPR News, I'm Dan Crocker in Duluth.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
Researchers across the country have suddenly found their work in limbo.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Clear Channel Outdoor, offering a nationwide network of billboards and data solutions that help businesses build brand awareness and influence consumer behavior. Billboardsforbusiness.com. And by Rubrik, dedicated to giving businesses the power to bounce back fast when cyber attacks target the cloud. More at Rubrik.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishour, in for David Brancaccio. Research scientists who get funding from the National Institutes of Health have had meetings about their grants canceled. This is happening at the same time as a ban on all external communication by the NIH and other agencies within Health and Human Services through February 1st. The NIH is the biggest funder of biomedical research in the world, and there's little clarity on why meetings are being canceled and whether it's a temporary pause or something bigger. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has more.
This Thursday, Gregory Ducker was supposed to be going to a meeting where he and a bunch of other scientists would review grant applications for NIH funding. But last week, he got an email.
Kind of a little cryptically saying that it was canceled.
Ducker is an assistant professor of biochemistry at the University of Utah, where he does NIH-funded research of his own. He says lots of scientists have had upcoming grant reviews canceled, and there's been no communication from the NIH about why or when they might be rescheduled.
People are anxious because the research is very dependent upon having funding renewed so that you can continue the studies.
It's not just grant review meetings. Rebecca Pompano, a professor of chemistry and biomedical engineering at the University of Virginia, was supposed to go to a training last week to be a grant reviewer, but it was canceled too.
20 minutes before it was supposed to start.
Without that training, she and others won't be able to review NIH funding applications. And even if all of this is just temporary and everything is rescheduled soon,
even a delay of a month or several months in funding could make the difference between a scientist being able to stay working on a particular research project or having to leave to get a different job somewhere else. And so you would lose that ability to pick up the research again.
Even if the grant eventually comes through. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is down 27 points. That is less than a tenth of a percent. The S&P 500 is down 1.5%. The NASDAQ is down 2.5%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Glassdoor, announcing the best places to work in 2025 based on anonymous reviews from real employees. Learn who's leading the way in employee satisfaction and see who's hiring at glassdoor.com/best places to work. And by Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses with customizable coverage options as unique as your business. More at progressivecommercial.com.
Having a mentor when you're young, receiving that investment of time, has economic returns. It can actually increase socioeconomic mobility. That's the takeaway from decades of data from the Big Brothers Big Sisters of America mentorship network. Former mentees got higher salaries in their early 20s compared to others in their cohort. They had better college attendance and healthier social bonds, according to this report. Marketplace Morning Report host David Brancaccio recently spoke with the president and CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters of America, Artis Stevens. Here's David.
I mean, you've gotten people to go through, it looks like, decades of data. And if people are concerned about economic inequality in society, apparently there's something you can do about it. Tell me more.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. For the mentorship, particularly on young people who had mentorship in our program, and this was data going back from 30 years ago of young people who were in our program with the control group of young people who were not, the participants in our program experienced a 20%, it was 20% more likelihood to attend college, 15% boost in their earnings in lifetime. And then being able to see that these young people who were typically in lower economic ladders be able to climb the social economic ladder and move up to higher economic brackets, right? So we know that this investment not only works for young people, we know the investment works for the impact of our society and our economy and our workforce and our education system. And that's why it's so pivotal and so important that more people are investing in mentorship in this country.
You've looked at the numbers, what it costs to do this kind of mentorship, and what society gets back in terms of if people make more money, they pay more taxes, and that contributes back. What did you find?
we saw really a focus on how it reduces the cost of social services. And it was based upon analysis that the government could recoup the cost. So the investment it actually costs to invest in a kid having mentorship, right? Being in a mentorship program, that cost is recouped in just 7 years. And then beyond those 7 years, what you start to see is even more ROI that is now coming back into communities, now coming back into the tax base. What we're also seeing that's aligned with other research is that the more that we have mentorship and seeing young people move into these higher levels of socioeconomic growth and opportunities, you have communities that then are less likely to have crime, less likely to have certain types of health decisions and health choices that are risky for young people, whether it's substance abuse, things that have to do with mental health and taking care of well-being. So there's a true ripple effect in terms of what an action, an investment of time in a young person's life can mean for the broader society and the work that we're doing to support everyone across this country.
And I know you're here representing Big Brothers Big Sisters, but we should acknowledge that you can mentor in many different ways.
It's one of the things what we talk about, this idea of access, right? Access is certainly for young people that have mentorship in their lives and they have positive adults, but access is also for the volunteer. 90% of our volunteers, what we call bigs, tell us that the young person made more impact on their lives than they made on theirs, right? That's their feeling, their perception. So when we say that mentorship is powerful, it's reciprocal. So it gives the idea of saying, yes, I can make a difference to what you just said, but it's also, I become better. I become more exposed. I become more engaged in my community. I have something that empowers me to be not just a better person, but a better contributor to society as well. And those are the types of things we want to continue to build. To your point, whether you come in and volunteer for Big Brothers, Big Sisters, or whether you're just a mentor in any aspect of your life, what we know is it works and it pays dividends and it has high ROI.
Artis Stevens, President CEO of Big Brothers, Big Sisters of America. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Artis Stevens was speaking there with Marketplace's David Brancaccio. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.